UBC is the only university in Western Canada to offer a master's program in film production. Now with a look at other UBC news, we go to Radio Free UBC. Here are Mariana Payette and Tristan Markle.
They schools can't teach us shit. My people need freedom. We trying to get all we can get. All my high school teachers could suck my dick. Telling me white man lies, straight bullshit.
Today on Radio Free UBC, the people's potato. How to pay tuition and still have enough money for food. And the big picture. An interview with AMS General Manager Bernie Peets.
Some people say you are what you eat. If that's true, then UBC students are unfree, because at UBC, food is quite pricey. And getting more so since the university's U-Town ideology has dictated that all new food outlets cater to UBC's new million-dollar condo population and to more wealthy students and staff. Over the past few weeks, however, some proactive students have begun an initiative to create a restaurant in the sub called the People's Potato that will provide free food at lunch. The food will be prepared by volunteers, though it is not necessary to volunteer to get food. The food will be vegan so as to be inclusive. The project is starting small, but hopes to become an established daily thing, not only embodying the principle that food is a human right, but also that preparing and eating food should be a community, even sacred event. If we are what we eat, the People's Potato may allow us to be socially and ecologically just and free, because free is the best thing to be. I think Immanuel Kant once said that. Radio Free UBC interviewed Mike Richardson, co-chair of the Student Environment Center, about the project.
So Mike, what is the general idea behind People's Potato, and why is it getting started here at UBC, and what are some of the principles and philosophies behind it?
Well, we're sort of trying to adapt it to UBC from the way it was started at Concordia, and there the idea is very much that with the rising cost of education, we think that, and they thought that people should still be able to eat a healthy meal, and that paying for education should not be so prohibitive that you starve trying to do it. So the idea behind it is that we take donated food, preferably food that supermarkets and food stores are throwing out, to sort of recycle the waste of society as well, and we try to cook a vegan lunch that has a balanced, healthy, nutritious meal, and we serve it to whoever wants it, and we try to sort of focus on making it a needs-based thing, where hopefully the people who are eating it, you can donate money if you have the money and can't afford it, but it really is there for people who might not be able to.
And where will the People's Potato be operating from, and when will it start happening?
The first one we're going to do is October 25th. We're not quite sure how often it will be. We're hoping for every 2 weeks, and then if it works, put it up to every week. Right now, we're very much going to do this as an experiment and see. We don't really know what it involves in terms of the challenges. In terms of location, we're not entirely sure yet. It depends on space constraints and some other constraints. We're trying to do it in conjunction with Knoll Aid, which is the concert in the Trek Park.
And so people know how they can get involved. What groups and individuals are involved in the project, and how can people come out to help make People's Potato happen?
One of the great things about it is it's been a very collaborative effort, so it's sort of been spearheaded by Brendan Goodmurphy, the AMS VP academic. There are people involved with it from the Student Environment Center, some people from Sprouts, some people who are also involved in Friends of the Farm, and it's really been a group effort, and anyone who's interested in helping out can get in touch with those groups maybe, and they can help direct you to this.
AMS VP academic Brendan Goodmurphy has also been helping to coordinate the project.
What is the philosophy behind the People's Potato? Short.
The philosophy is that everyone should have access to education, and students who can't afford to buy their own food should have a free meal provided for them. So that's the philosophy behind it, and then it's usually vegan so that everybody can access it and meet all dietary needs.
Do you think that it's a problem that the AMS runs for-profit businesses to raise money for itself and then will also offer free food, or do you think that's not a big problem?
I don't think it's a problem, because I think it will be a student group within the AMS who will get the food donated and cook it and serve it.
They schools can't teach
just shit. My people need freedom. We trying to get all we could get. All my high school teachers could suck my dick, telling me white man lies, straight bullshit.
As part of Radio Free UBC's Big Picture interview series, we talked to the AMS's general manager, Bernard Peets. Bernie Peets has been the GM for over 13 years and is the pillar behind the society. So we went to talk to him to find out really important things about living on planet Earth and ask bigger questions, more interesting questions than people usually ask important people.
A lot of people say that if you're under 30 and you're not a socialist, you have no heart. But if you're over 30 and you're still a socialist, then you have no brain. What do you think about that?
I think there's a lot of truth to that, actually. But having been a socialist when I was under 30, I now consider myself quite smart.
Thank you very much. And do you think that there is racism at UBC?
Unfortunately, I think there is some. I mean, certainly there's been some incidents over the last few years, Hillel House, the Muslim prayer room, and some other things that happened. I don't think it's widespread. I think it's a lot less than society in general, but unfortunately I think it does exist.
Do you think you are smarter than the average person?
I think I have a fair amount of intelligence. I don't know that I would say that I was smarter than the average person, because I'm not too sure what that that level of intelligence actually is. I think I'm perceptive, and I think that perception translates into some effective ways of doing things, but I don't know that that necessarily means I'm more intelligent or less intelligent than others.
As a follow-up question to that, is the universe expanding?
Yes, as it should.
How many countries are there in Africa, and can you name them?
I don't know how many there are. I can name a number of them, but I could not name them all. They change names every second month. So, do you want me to actually name them, the ones that I can think of?
Yeah.
Yeah? Okay. Egypt, Libya, Kenya, South Africa, Zimbabwe, Rwanda. No, Rwanda isn't a country. No. Ghana, is it still called Ghana? Yeah, okay. See, you're putting me on the spot.
No, that was the most we've gotten.
Madagascar.
So far. Oh, Madagascar.
Madagascar.
And do you have an Oedipal complex?
No, I do not.
Revolution or reform?
Sorry?
Revolution or reform?
Reform.
Sorry?
Reform. Evolution, actually. Evolution rather than revolution.
Okay. Are you heterosexual? And if so, is it 100% or is there some wiggle room?
I'm heterosexual, but I don't know that there's necessarily 100% of anything, anybody.
And is UBC the best school on Earth?
I don't think so.
What's the derivative of x squared?
The derivative of x squared? I don't even know what derivatives are, but I would say x.
That's pretty close. That's good. That was great. Thank you, Bernie
Peets,
for taking part in the Big Picture.
And here are some Radio Free announcements for the week.
Last year at this time, the Anti-Poverty Committee launched a coordinated housing offensive in the downtown East Side. The APC occupied abandoned buildings, demanding that they be converted for long-term social housing. This Sunday, the APC will launch into another housing offensive. With a year to go until next municipal elections, APC is putting pressure on municipal and provincial governments and demanding the immediate implementation of a homeless action plan, an anti-vacancy bylaw, and an immediate moratorium on condo development in the downtown East Side. The squat will begin on Sunday, October 14th at 2 p.m.
Again, the APC event is Sunday at 2 p.m. in the Victory Square Park at Cambie and Hastings. On Tuesday, October 16th, walk, bus, bike, drive, there's going to be a transportation debate at St. Helens Anglican Church. UBC debaters will be there debating transportation options at 7 p.m. Go to www.telus.net/GW Forum for more information. On October 17th, there's going to be an MLA Day of Action. The Western Canadian Wilderness Committee is going to Gordon Campbell's office to demand that old-growth foresting be stopped in BC. Join the Facebook group for updates. October 27th to November 3rd is the Salmon Farming Week of Action. Email smackinnon at livingoceans.org if you're interested in volunteering. And don't forget, October 25th is Knoll Aid. It's a Stick It to the Man jam in Trek Park. The fun starts at 12.
And thanks to Radio Free UBC for that piece. We'll now take a look at local and provincial news with our News 101 reporters, Carrie Baptist, Leanne Yu, and Tracy Fuller.
Vancouver residents can possibly breathe a little easier, literally. The city and striking outside workers have just reached a tentative agreement. A statement released by the city says both sides have reached a settlement consistent with the recommendations of mediator Brian Foley. The decision is surprising, considering the city expressed they were less than optimistic about a settlement just this morning. However, members of QP 1004 will still have to vote on the recommendations this Sunday. The union's executive is encouraging members to vote yes. Library workers are continuing to walk the picket line. City librarian Paul Whitney says he doesn't know how the dynamic of the strike will change, with two of the three striking unions already reaching agreements.
In other strike news, members of QP Local 15, the union representing the City of Vancouver's inside workers, are back on the job after voting in favor of a mediator's proposal. The decision brings an end to the lengthy 12-week-long civic strike, at least for one branch of the union. Many of the other local members are unhappy with Local 15's decision to end their strike before all the other QP factions reached similar agreements with the city, and some turned up at to City Hall on Thursday to meet the returning members and voice their disappointment. Some have said they have been left out in the cold while other former strikers return back to work.
Parking tickets issued during the civic strike will be collected by the city. Vancouver city managers say that they are prepared to appear in court according to the regular processes in order to enforce parking tickets. City manager Jerry Dobrovolny said drivers may have thought they were free to park without plugging the meter for the past few months, but the first surprise came in the form of a ticket. Now drivers can brace for a not-so-quick court appearance. Dobrovolny admits that this would be expensive for the city, but says he will assess the situation as it develops.
Mark your calendars, sports fans. Vanock announced the prices for tickets to Olympic events yesterday, which are set to go on sale a year from Thursday on October 11, 2008. The Vancouver Olympic Committee claims that all income levels will be able to afford Olympic tickets. There has been a lot of speculation over the ticket prices for the 2010 Vancouver Olympics, so the VAN OC has released some information about how tickets will be priced in a bid to calm fears. The price of tickets will depend on the popularity of the sport. For the opening ceremony, tickets will range from $175 to $1,100. For an extremely popular event, like the men's gold medal hockey game, tickets will cost between $350 and $775. But not all event tickets will cost that much. For a men's round-robin hockey game, the range will be from $50 to $140, and for curling, $65. Vanock says their goal is to let as many spectators participate as possible in the Olympics. For that reason, 100,000 tickets to other events will cost only $25. Despite the extravagant prices for most events, Vanock is promising that 50,000 subsidized tickets will be set aside and given to community groups and nonprofit organizations.
The BC-based National Sex Party is accusing the province of being, quote, sex negative. The Sex Party is challenging the province in federal court over the Postal Service's refusal to deliver its 2006 federal election pamphlet. The pamphlet in question featured artsy photos of a straddled male torso and a phallic sculpture. According to the Sex Party, they are victims of unfair discrimination. In the same election year, the Post delivered an anti-gay religious tract even after mail carriers objected. Sex Party lawyer John Ince justified the case, saying it is quite an important case in defining the grounds on which sexual material can be censored by the government.
Homeless shelters across BC will soon keep their doors open 24 hours a day instead of closing in the mornings. The announcement came today from Premier Gordon Campbell and Housing Minister Rich Coleman on a visit to a Vancouver shelter. The new change means shelters will no longer have to drive the homeless back outside each morning. Presently, people are required to line up for spots in the shelter each afternoon. They spend the night, but have to go out back onto the streets in the morning. The decision comes as part of a multifaceted provincial housing movement. Other changes include more outreach workers to assist the homeless with social services and a limited number of grants to help out with recipients' monthly rent payments. We're going to take another break now, but when we come back, we'll update you on national and international news. Stay with us. News 101 will continue right after this.
BCSportsBeat.ca is your source on the internet dedicated to providing you with information on professional and amateur sports in your province. You'll find game scores, team updates, and the perspective of the athletes through in-depth interviews, all at bcsportsbeat.ca. bcsportsbeat.ca, your source for BC sports.
On Sunday, October 28th, 2007, at 3 p.m., Kokoro Dance will present Heart, Mind, Spirit, and Soul. Critically acclaimed Kokoro Dance combines kinetic and visual elements from Japan and the West to create a uniquely Canadian Buto aesthetic. The company has produced over 900 performances and created more than 150 dance works that have been performed across Canada, in the United States, and in Europe. With Carolyn Chan and Holly Holt, this concert is presented as the second in our Sunday series of three dance and music performances entitled Stimulating the Senses, Music and Movement at MOA. That's Kokoro Dance performing Heart, Mind, Spirit and Soul on Sunday, October 28th at 3 p.m. For more information, please visit www.moa.ubc.ca.
I'm Peter Mansbridge, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
5:22, and the news continues on CITR. In an election which boasted one of the lowest voter turnouts in Ontario history, Premier Dalton McGuinty was re-elected for another term, representing a big win for the Liberals and a humiliating loss for the Conservatives and their candidate, John Tory. A Conservative defeat in the province is not what analysts expected. Tory caused a stir in Ontario when he suggested that public money should be used to fund private, religious-based schools, a platform on which confused voters and cost Tory the projected win. Daryl Bricker of the Ipsos Reid polling firm said that it takes a real commitment to lose to have this happen, referring to Tory's actions. Bricker also states that Prime Minister Stephen Harper would be wise to learn from Tory's example and avoid contentious social issues in the event of a fall federal election, following the vote of confidence against the minority government later this month. Now with more national news, here is Tracy Fuller.
There were some eyebrows raised on Parliament Hill this afternoon after Prime Minister Stephen Harper announced the appointment of former Liberal Deputy Minister John Manley to head a committee on Canada's role in Afghanistan. The appointment is being seen as a strategic move from the Conservatives 4 days before Harper's throne speech. Harper told the press that the government needs a full, open, and informed debate on what Canada's role should or shouldn't be after February of 2009, when the mission is set to end. Working alongside Manley will be four other prominent Canadians: former journalist Pamela Wallin, former U.S. Ambassador Derek Burney, Bombardier CEO Paul Tellier, and former Mulroney Health Minister Jake Epp. Harper says he wanted the committee to be nonpartisan in nature. The five-person committee will travel to Afghanistan to make their assessment about how best Canada can provide aid to the country. They will then make their recommendations directly to Harper in January and then to parliamentarians. Meanwhile, NDP leader Jack Layton criticized the high-powered panel Friday, saying that the issue is essentially one of policy, which parliamentarians should discuss rather than outsiders.
And in international news, we go to our foreign correspondent, Peter Otis from Copenhagen in Denmark. This week, Peter sent us a piece on Cucumber Week.
I admit that not every day is fresh and exciting, even when you're on exchange. In Denmark, a slow news day is called a cucumber day. Well, one could say that I've had a cucumber week. You see, the first few weeks after I arrived here in Copenhagen, everything around me was fresh and exciting, and so it was easy to think of ideas for features, but as I settle in, the task is becoming more and more challenging. Now, if I was looking for scapegoats, I could certainly blame the Danish social and political system. You see, much like Canada, Denmark is a boring country. Our societies are peaceful. Our institutions are relatively well-functioning. There's no corruption or mass atrocities. Now, don't get me wrong. I mean, I understand that this is the very reason why Denmark and Canada are consistently rated among the best places to live. It just doesn't make for very interesting journalism. But just as I was about to draft an email to Rita and Katie apologizing for a lack of feature, an idea popped into my mind. How about doing a segment about Danish headlines that might surprise and amuse? You can call it filler if you like, but please be easy on me. It's been a cucumber week. Last weekend, I left Copenhagen to explore the rest of Denmark. I mean, you gotta love being in a country where you can travel from one tip to the other in less than 6 hours. While in the city of Aarhus, I experienced my first run-in with a car. I was in the bike lane and a car was turning right, not noticing me. I guess I must have been in his blind spot because he didn't even slow down as he turned and cut me off. Thankfully, I managed to swerve and only punch out his rearview mirror before he stopped. Well, as this week's Copenhagen Post informed me, I'm not the only one to have experienced such an accident. According to the Royal Directorate, 30 cyclists are seriously injured in that very incident each year, and about 10 of them die. Okay, let's see, what else? Oh yeah, while I was away, the Copenhagen police set a new record when it arrested 436 protesters on Saturday. As you may have guessed from my previous features, the protests began as a peaceful gathering of the Youth House movement. The police spokesman is quoted in the article as saying that he's thankful that no Molotov cocktails were thrown and that no cars were burned this time around. I guess you gotta be happy with the small successes, don't you? Now let's move on to royal news. The country swelled with pride last week when Prince Joachim announced his engagement to French sweetheart Marie Cavalier. As tends to be the case with every royal marriage, Danish media have been working overtime trying to find a juicy detail on the young French woman. But thus far...
And thanks, as always, to Peter for that interesting piece. In other international news, in an act of never-before-seen cooperation between Islamic leaders, 138 Muslim scholars of the Shia, Sunni, and Sufi sects have written a letter to Christian leaders around the world. The letter calls for peace and understanding between Islam and Christianity, because, as the letter states, the very survival of the world is perhaps at stake. The letter is addressed to Christian dignitaries, including Pope Benedict the 16th, and Archbishop of Canterbury, Rowan Williams, is the first of its kind, as there is no international body or leader representing Muslims to the world to date. Arif Ali Nayed, a signatory and senior advisor to the Cambridge University Interfaith Program in Britain, says an ad hoc network of Muslim leaders has been set up as a result of this letter, which may lead to cooperation in the future and the possibilities of similar letters addressed to Jews or secularists. This letter comes after calls made by Muslim leaders for a Muslim-Christian dialogue after Pope Benedict suggested in a speech that Islam was violent and irrational. A Vatican official said the Roman Catholic Church will decline to comment until they have read the entire letter. It's now time for another break here on News 101, but stay tuned for commentary and much more coming up on the other side.
T-shirts,
well-mannered cardigans,
pants, jackets, and underwear.
The Friends of CITR card scores you discounts at Antisocial, Berku's Angels, and Hits Boutique.
Uzbekistan prints or Rajasthan colors.
Support CITR Radio and pick up your card today.
Heard about CITR's second annual funding drive? It's a great way to help out the station that keeps you posted on all the latest independent and underground local musical talent. Now's your chance to donate and keep us on air for another fantastic year of lyrical melodies.
Donations will go towards new equipment and regular upkeeping of our radness, which ultimately transcends back to you, the listeners, in form of sweet music.
Call our line between October 1st and the 14th and donate a piece of your heart
and wealth.
Note, your donations will get you some free CITR stuff.
Yeah! That means t-shirts, hoodies, bags, CDs, a friend's card, and more.
Wow! Reach us at 604-822-8648.
Once again, that's 604-822-8648.
I totally love this radio station.
I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now!, daily grassroots, global, unembedded, international, independent news hour. And this is CITR 101.9 FM.
Welcome back to News 101. It's now 5:32. Former U.S. Vice President and climate change proponent Al Gore is the recipient of this year's Nobel Peace Prize. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell has more.
Former Vice President and presidential candidate Al Gore wins the Nobel Peace Prize for his work on climate change.
We have to quickly find a way to change the world's consciousness about exactly what we're facing and why we have to work to solve it. I'm going back to work right now. This is just the beginning.
Gore and the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change joined the ranks of Nelson Mandela, Desmond Tutu, Martin Luther King Jr., and Jimmy Carter as the select few to attain such recognition for their work to promote peace. But this is the first time the issue of climate change has been determined a necessity for peace. To talk about this and the latest in climate change, FSRN's Leanne Caldwell spoke with Kevin Knobloch, president of the Union of Concerned Scientists.
Well, Kevin, thanks so much for joining us today. We really appreciate it. Connecting peace to global warming, that's a big deal, right?
I think it's a very big deal. The Nobel Committee clearly is thinking about the greatest threats to humankind, to the ability of this planet to sustain life. And they chose to recognize Al Gore, of course, and the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, who in each in their own ways has brought the science of global warming into people's living rooms and into the halls of power.
What was so successful in their approaches? I mean, 5, 10 years ago, global warming was still considered a myth?
Well, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change is a group of some 2,000 scientists from across the globe. And these are highly credentialed scientists who spend their days studying some facet of climate change. And they have, through a sequence of so-called assessments over recent years, communicated to the world leaders the state of climate science. It's actually a conservative approach in how they do it. And what they have increasingly found is that the pace of climate change is accelerating, that the actual observed changes, the observed data, is more alarming than what the models showed in earlier years. So, for example, the IPCC found that a 3 to 7 degree Fahrenheit increase in the average global temperature could result in the loss of 30% of the world's species, and that water shortages in drought-stricken areas would affect hundreds of millions of people. So by bringing the science forward in that way, they really have helped us understand what is at stake.
But there's a new IPCC report coming out in November. Some are suggesting, including Tim Flanney, who's an Australian scientist, he's suggesting that the new report is going to say that greenhouse emissions are causing climate change at a faster pace than they ever thought, and that it could be irreversible. Is that something that we should be expecting coming out of this November report?
Well, I have not seen the final report, so I hesitate to speculate. I think there's no question that when the last assessment was put out earlier this year, that it had not taken into account more recent studies showing, in particular, the accelerating melting of the ice caps and the Greenland ice sheet, and that new science will, in fact, be captured in this upcoming assessment. There's no question that climate scientists agree that the pace of climate change and its harmful impacts is, in fact, outpacing what earlier models projected.
Well, to bring it full circle, do you think that this Nobel Peace Prize will give the upcoming November report more weight?
Yes, I do. I think not enough policymakers in Congress and the state governments in the White House have given adequate heed to the IPCC assessments before this time. And so they don't fully grasp that we have to move very quickly now. We have an intergenerational responsibility to put the policies in place over the next few years that will put us on a path of reducing greenhouse gases by 80% from today's levels by the year 2050. That's the order of the lift that we have ahead of us. And yes, this Nobel recognition, I think, will put a very positive spotlight on the IPCC, on this next report, and is a terrific validation of Vice President Gore's leadership, which has been just without par.
Kevin, thank you so much for your time today. I appreciate it.
You're welcome, Leanne.
That was FSRN's Leanne Caldwell speaking with Kevin Knobloch, president of the Union of Concerned Scientists.
And thanks to FSRN for making that piece available to us for rebroadcast. It's now time for commentary, and this week, Phil Caudry discusses Stephen Harper's latest political maneuver to control the political dialogue, setting the throne speech later as a means to stifle opposition and getting it passed in the House of Commons. Phil also discusses how Dion could capitalize on Harper's penchant for ruling with an iron fist.
While Stephen Harper has not delivered one word from his throne speech, set to take place next week to outline the agenda for the coming year, it is already mired in controversy. Harper has scheduled the speech to begin at 6:35 in the evening, at least 3 hours later than it is conventionally given. While this seems harmless at first glance, it could have a significant impact upon whether Harper's government remains leading, or if they lose this confidence vote, which would lead to a fall election. This unprecedented move effectively reduces the ability for opposition parties, the media, and the public to digest the contents of the speech and make an educated evaluation of it. With little time between the throne speech and the evening news, it will be nearly impossible for the Liberals to give a unified response, especially on contentious issues such as the Afghan mission. What Harper is doing is purely for self-interest, with no benefit to Canadians or the democratic process. Harper has made it known that he does not want to go into an election mode, and he is hoping that this additional measure will help his minority government hold on to power. It is unclear if the opposition plans to muster enough support to keep the Conservative government afloat. In recent polls, the Tories have opened a 7-point lead against the Liberals nationally. While this margin would bring them back to power, it would more than likely result in another minority government forming. Therefore, Harper is showing his true Conservative colors by playing it safe and not risking a Liberal upset victory. Dion has strongly hinted that he and his party plan to support the throne speech. This decision is also due to the latest poll numbers released, but also after the Quebec by-election meltdown for the party. So as long as the Liberal Party does not splinter in terms of support, or if they simply abstain from voting, it looks like the Tories will be in a good position to maintain power. Therefore, the latest political maneuver by Harper is not only unethical, but unnecessary. He is simply trying to get the Liberals to make a rushed decision and support the government's throne speech. This political maneuver fits in with Harper's overbearing method of managing his caucus. Harper controls the party message with an iron fist and has essentially taken the same mentality as an egotistical frontman of a successful rock band. He is the only one that matters since he is in the spotlight, and therefore he will dictate the terms of engagement. We have seen this with his treatment of the press, by only choosing a shortlisted number of reporters to field him softball questions. His obsession with creating a controlled environment is simply manifesting itself further. What he does not realize, however, is that in politics, if you try to control too many factors, people will take notice. If there is anything worse than being perceived as anti-democratic as a politician in Canada, I don't know it. Harper is walking the fine line between a calculating politician and an anti-democratic one, who will not listen to any form of dissonance, whether it be from external forces or within his own party. If Dion is smart, he might be able to capitalize on this issue, not unlike how Harper capitalized on the sponsorship scandal, as a means of putting a rival's credibility into question. It is unlikely to garner as much of a profile as an electoral issue, but it could significantly close the credibility gap between the Liberals and the Conservatives. It might even cause the Conservatives to have to play catch-up on credibility, an issue that helped bring them to power. If Harper isn't careful, he could see that 7-point lead turn into a 17-point disadvantage. For News 101 Commentary, I'm Phil Caudry.
And thanks for that, Phil. It's now time for the Arts Report with Katie Fitzpatrick.
Hello, I'm Katie Fitzpatrick, and welcome to your weekly Arts Beat, where we tell you what there is to check out so you know what to go out and see. First of all, there's Futuristi currently playing at UBC. Bella Luna and Theatre at UBC present the Canadian premiere of a piece of avant-garde theatre from the turn of the century Italian Futurist movement. That plays tonight and tomorrow night at 7:30 at the Frederick Wood Theatre. Next up, there's His Greatness. The Arts Club Theatre Company presents the premiere of Daniel Malakoff's play inspired by an early 1980s Vancouver visit by Tennessee Williams. That plays from October 11th to November 7th at the Granville Island Stage at 1585 Johnson, and we're going to have a review of that on the November 23rd Arts Show. Next up is Radio Days, which is applicable to us here as radio DJs. Hoa Kanhoto's comedy about the hijinks that ensue at a local radio station in the 1940s when a famous actor arrives to star in a broadcast. That's also October 11th to 27th at the Gateway Theatre at 6500 Gilbert Road in Richmond. Also showing in theater is Stupidity. Theater Conspiracy presents the English language premiere of Argentine playwright Raphael Spiegelberg's comedy, translated and adapted by Crispin Whittell, with Richard Wolff directing Alan Morgan, Johan Helf, Nicole LaRue, Alex Zahara, and Naomi Wright. That runs October 11th to 21st at Studio 16 at 1551 West 7th, and that actually features some UBC alumni, so you may want to check it out for that reason. Just so you know, also, the next show showing through the UBC Theater is at the Dorothy Somerset Studio Theater, and that's called Death and Taxes. It's October 18th to 20th. MFA director Patrick Gauthier introduces us to an undead patriarch in his award-winning satire about life, work, death, and bears. Finally, ongoing in theater is 448 Sarcosis. Horseshoes and Hand Grenades Theater presents the Western Canadian premiere of Sarah Kane's drama about a woman struggling with sanity and her will to live. That's directed by Mindy Parfit, and it runs till tomorrow night, October 13th, the Fire Hall Arts Center at 280 East Cordova. And you can find a review of that one in this week's edition of the Georgia Strait. In music, Western Front New Music presents the sound artist Danielle Mensch from Portland with composer and improviser Chris Kelly. That's tonight at 8 p.m. at Western Front at 303 East 8th. Fall Into Light, a concert of contemporary Canadian sacred music performed by Music Intima. That's also tonight at 8 p.m. at West Vancouver United Church. Baroque to Classical, a musical journey. The VSO performs works by Mozart, Bach, and Schubert, featuring UBC School of Music faculty member Sarah Davis Bushner on piano. That's tonight and tomorrow night at 8 p.m. at the Chance Center for the Performing Arts here at UBC. It also shows on October 15th at 8 p.m. at the Centennial Theatre in North Vancouver. In comedy this week, there's Too Funny. Kimberly's Comedy Corner, Inc. presents the screening of the first episode of a new independently produced stand-up comedy TV series. That's tomorrow night at 6:30 p.m. at the Burnet Lake Theatre at Queen's Park, New West. Mike Wolff's Comedy Night at the Wired Bean. Showcase of local comedy talent featuring Sean Proudlove, Mike Thomas, Alicia Tobin, Matt Howlett, Dennis Latondua, and Jimmy Barnes with MC Ben Mills. That's October 13th at 9 p.m. at the Wired Bean at 200 West Esplanade, North Vancouver. In literary events, Robert Marshall, SFU's Writer Studio, hosts a reading by the New York-based author of A Separate Reality. That's October 12th from 7 to 9 p.m. at the Blends Coffee Shop at 508 West Hastings. Readings on the Corner. The Canadian Authors Association presents readings by Sandra Harper, Breaking Out, and Patrick Taylor, an Irish country doctor. That's tomorrow night at 3 p.m. at the Cornerstone Cafe in Coquitlam. Also, the big news in literary events is the upcoming Vancouver International Writers and Readers Festival. The 20th annual Literary Fest features events with more than 35 authors from around Canada and the world. That's October 16th to 21st, and it's going to be at various venues on Granville Island. In galleries, there's one interesting exhibit. It's called Leaving My Found Eden, a Poetography Exhibit. Now, that's showing at the Vancouver East Cultural Centre. It's by Ron L. Zhang, and it runs till October 17th. If you're wondering what poetography is, it's a new art form merging traditional Chinese and Japanese and contemporary Western cultures. And so, basically, it's a combining of black and white photography and poetry. Also up in galleries, there's the Cityscape Community Art Space in Lonsdale, North Vancouver, which is showing Oil, Terror, and the Super Unconscious, works by Richard Watley, Ryan Huffman, and Zoe Pollack. That runs till October 26th. At the Contemporary Art Gallery at 555 Nelson, they're showing Copywork, mixed media show by Vancouver photographer Chris Gurgley till November 8th, and RSVP, a series of meals in which audience diners create a social performance with the help of venue hosts. Guest curated by Jermaine Coe at multiple venues. That's October 19th to 28th. At the Pendulum Gallery at the HSBC building at 885 West Georgia, they're showing Downtown East Side photo exhibit. Pivot Legal Society presents a community-based project utilizing disposable cameras till October 20th. This is a project that's been getting a lot of media attention in recent times, you may have noticed. That's all we've got for listings today. I hope you get a chance to go and check some of those things out and enjoy your week. I've also got a couple more announcements. The official first edition of an entire Arts Scoop show is going to be beginning on Tuesday, and that's with myself, Katie Fitzpatrick. It's going to be playing from then on from Tuesdays to 2 and 2:30. First show on October 16th. We're going to have a review of Closer. We're going to have a few interviews, review of art galleries, listings, and music. The second announcement is, as you probably already know, the CITR funding drive is on right now. If you want to support more programming like this, you can dial 822-1242 or you can visit our website at citr.ca. Thanks, and that's your weekly Arts Beat. I'm Katie Fitzpatrick.
And thanks, Katie, for that shameless plug for the funding drive. But before we go tonight and head into sports for this evening, we're going to check in with Selena Ferris, our meteorologist, for a look at your weekend weather. Selena?
Well, it's looking like we'll be getting some nice weather over the weekend. A weak blocking ridge will act to deflect storms over the next few days. Saturday and Sunday, we'll see a dry mix of sun and cloud. Temperatures will remain cool in the low teens during the day and dropping down below 10 degrees overnight. By the beginning of next week, expect to see those winter storms rolling in again. That's your weekend weather, brought to you by the Storm Club at UBC. For more information, you can email us at stormubc@gmail.com.
Thanks for that, Selena. That's some good weather news for once, hey?
Yeah, it really is. Finally.
Great. So that's our program for October 12, 2007. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. And if you'd like to share your comments, give us a hot news tip, or get involved with the show, contact us. Our phone number is 604-822-5334, or you can email news@citr.ca.
Megan Turcotto produced this radio program. For more news, join us Monday at 5 p.m. for the next edition of News 101. For the entire news team here at CITR, I'm Katie Comley.
And I'm Rita Farkas. Thanks for listening. Coming up next on CITR Sports Friday, Thunderball 2007 from War Memorial Gym. This is CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.